good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we're hoping to have with us this evening Dr. Garth Nicholson, who is certainly one of my favorite guests. He has held actually two professorships at the MD Anderson Cancer Clinic in Texas for many years. He taught at the medical school there. I talked to some of his residents, and certainly he was widely acclaimed as one of the leading teachers in the school, and everybody just loved him. He was on the editorial staff of at least 10 scientific journals and edited several scientific journals himself. And then, well, we won't get into the background of why he left Texas, other than to say that he came to California, and he has, of course, a clinic here where he does his own scientific research, the Institute on Molecular Medicine. And with that as a background, Dr. Nicholson is on the line. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you again.
Well, of course, we don't have any real planned program for tonight, but I'm sure you can get us abreast of the things that are happening, you know, in so many of the diseases, these relatively new diseases that, you know, really plague so many people today. One of the interesting things that I'd mentioned when we talked off the air was this new report that had come out of the Veterans Administration in San Diego, where after some 10, 12 years after the first Gulf War, a scientific group had come to the conclusion that, yes, there really is a Gulf War illness. These people are not all crazy. And we're talking about several hundred of the 690-some thousand young men and women who went to the Gulf. What's your take on this new report of saying that the Gulf War illness is not imaginary, it's not post-traumatic stress, it's a very real clinical disease?
Well, this is long overdue. And in fact, the facts were there for anyone to examine, and they have been for a long time. And the facts have been primarily masked by propaganda. And there was a tremendous propaganda campaign after the Gulf War that the veterans weren't sick, and then that they were sick with psychological illnesses like post-traumatic stress disorder, not medical illnesses caused by organic changes and toxic exposures. So finally that gave way to the fact that they just couldn't explain it any longer with post-traumatic stress disorder as a diagnosis. In fact, even the psychiatrists that were studying this, even though 80% of the funds for Gulf War illness were going to psychiatrists to simply reinforce what the Pentagon had decided or pre-decided was the problem, all of a sudden things started falling apart. And I think this is the culmination of that. There are a number of studies out now showing that the veterans have been exposed to chemicals and biologicals. And we've been involved in this. Of course, we were the first to find evidence for biological exposures from the Gulf War, and we think now that they were from the vaccines. And that's probably why there was a major cover-up going on.
And of course,
failure to admit that these were friendly fire diseases.
And of course, this was the Mycoplasma fermentis that appeared to be genetically altered.
That's correct, and that's just one of the microorganisms that we've found and now others have found. We've also found some evidence for Brucella. And, of course, the microorganisms that we found, I should remind you that these were worked on by our own government laboratories as incapacitating biological weapons.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we're talking about the Gulf War illness. And Dr. Nicholson was mentioning that they have found not only evidence of Mycoplasma fermentans there, a genetically altered bacteria that had been worked on by our own government laboratories as incapacitating agents. But Brucella, which is a chronic, well, that's of course the old undulating fever, but this can create a chronic disability. Have there been any other organisms found that in these patients?
Yersinia pestis, which is the plague-causing bacterium. And of course, during the Middle Ages, approximately one-third of Europe was wiped out by Yersinia pestis, carried mainly by insects that were on rodents and other vermin. And of course, they had no way to fight back during the Middle Ages, so people either survived or they died.
Yeah, well, now, of course, if this was in our troops, were they treated with antibiotics? Were they recognized or is this genetically modified so that it doesn't kill, it just incapacitates?
Well, we don't know either the story about the Brucella or the Yersinia pestis. We just did not have enough evidence one way or another. We had most of our actual evidence on Mycoplasma fermentans. And the interesting thing about that that we found is that many of the patients with a variety of chronic illnesses have similar types of infections, but they're not quite the same. There are a variety of different types of mycoplasmas that can cause illness in humans, and we found essentially all of these in chronic illness patients, particularly fatiguing illnesses, but also other illnesses like inflammatory bowel disorders, for example, rheumatic diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and things like this. But there are a variety of different species that were involved, about a half a dozen, that we found in these patients, and that was really in striking contrast to what we found in the veterans with Gulf War illness. There we found more than 80% of the cases that were positive had only one type of mycoplasma, this Mycoplasma fermentans, and a very unusual one at that.
Well, now, of course, we hear all sorts of descriptions of how many people are ill. Some people say it's 200,000. Some people say it's 300,000 or 400,000. Do we have any idea how many percent of that, or how many of those 695,000 veterans we sent to the Gulf are really ill?
Well, there are at least 150,000 that registered, indicating that they had signs and symptoms. Otherwise, they wouldn't be registered with the Department of Veterans Affairs or the Department of Defense. And I'm not quite sure of the 150,000 what the breakdown would be in terms of what types of illnesses and so on.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, the Institute for Molecular Medicine here in Southern California. We were requesting the number of veterans who actually are ill of the 695,000 that were sent to the Gulf. Dr. Nicholson says there are about 150,000 that were actually registered. Do you think that's with the Veterans Administration as having a disability, medical disability as far as the Gulf War? Now, that's, of course, entirely different than the field casualties, people who were wounded, things of that sort.
Well, yes. I mean, there were very few that were actually, during the first Gulf War, wounded or killed in action. In fact, there were only about 150 that were killed in action during the conflict. So this is a number that is just amazing in terms of the size of the number compared to the actual casualties, battlefield casualties. And in fact, the other interesting aspect of this is that these, what we call delayed casualties, occurred across the units, often that were never even near combat zones, that were in supply, command and control, support units, and so on, well behind the lines. So not all these casualties even were near areas where major combat was occurring.
And well, didn't some of it occur even in people who were preparing to deploy and didn't deploy, suggesting perhaps it was in the vaccines?
Yes, that's the interesting aspect, and there are a couple of studies on this, one a British study and one an American study, and these were done by epidemiologists. And they studied the deployed forces and compared them to non-deployed forces, and also they compared them to forces that were inoculated with the multiple vaccines but not deployed. And the interesting thing is that the inoculated but non-deployed forces had intermediate rates of chronic illness compared to the deployed forces that were immunized and the non-deployed which were not immunized. So that gives you an indication that even if you weren't deployed and you received the vaccines, you were at a certain risk for coming down with Gulf War illnesses.
Well, now, of course, you mentioned earlier that there was a certain component of our troops who were exposed to toxic substances. I'm sure that would include the sarin gas that came from when they blew up the poison gas dump there. And then, of course, there were the fires. And then there were the various things that the insecticides that they put on the uniforms. And the pyridostigmine bromide that they were required to take is totally experimentally, as far as I'm concerned, because I don't think they've ever given that to normal people, have they, for any period of time?
Well, only to patients that were ill with myasthenia gravis, right, and a few other different diseases. But no, it had not been given to at the number that were given to healthy people. And so it was very, very experimental, and I think it was very ill-conceived. In fact, the funny thing was, is that, and it's really not funny at all, is that they were given the PB pills to combat Iraqi nerve agents. But in fact, the PB is really only effective against Soman. But the Iraqis were not using Soman, they were using sarin. And the PB is not that effective against sarin. So it was absolutely the wrong thing to give the forces.
But, of course, nobody has ever called to a task for making a poor value judgment, and we got an awful lot of sick soldiers out there, and people, left over with really permanent, it appears almost like a permanent disability. Now, some of the people actually were improved, at least those with mycoplasm, with the antibiotic treatment. Was that your experience?
That was our experience, although the government claims differently because they ran a clinical trial. We felt very flawed clinical trial, and they started to see a difference between the antibiotic and the placebo arms of the trial, and then all of a sudden it flipped, and the study went exactly opposite, and we think there's something terribly wrong with the study because the placebo patients were reverting to mycoplasma negative phenotype at the same rate as the test patients who were receiving antibiotics, and we've never seen anything like that. So it's as if the placebo was effectively treating the mycoplasmal infections. So this is, I think, an extremely flawed study. But sure, yet they've used that to justify keeping antibiotics away from veterans that have Gulf War illness, even if they're positive for these types of infections.
Well, unfortunately, sometimes scientific studies are altered so that they will be politically correct rather than scientifically correct. And I heard a talk given recently by a friend of mine, Doctor. I don't know if you know Dr. Art Robinson, but he's gave up his career at the University of Southern California in chemistry and moved to Oregon, where he has his own Oregon Medical Institute. And he was telling a story a couple of weeks ago when I attended a meeting about this extensive study that he had done, and he never could figure why it didn't come out the way it was supposed to. And only years later, he found out that one of the other scientists who was sort of competing with him had actually gone in and changed the results, and he had told somebody back at the NIH that exactly what he'd done. And, it was only 20 years later that Dr. Robinson realized that his studies, his figures, had all been altered in the middle of the night by a competing scientist. Terrible to think about that sort of thing going on in science, but I guess scientists are humans like everybody else.
Well, it does happen, and we had some incidents like that happen to us where they tried to destroy samples in our laboratory and tried to put people in our lab that caused us nothing but trouble and so on, and also tried to send us bad samples. One study that we tried to do with the Department of Defense, they were to send us blind samples, and we were going to test them. And then we finally figured out that they had frozen and thawed these blood samples, three, four, I don't know how many times, and of course that totally destroys the nucleic acid, the DNA that we were trying to use to find the microorganisms that we were looking for. And so these were samples which were completely dead. The only problem that we had was when we went back to do the controls, they sent us blood samples and we couldn't detect the DNA from the white blood cells in the blood. It was all degraded. So that told us that the samples were totally destroyed that they had sent us. And yet they were drawing major conclusions on the basis of that totally flawed study.
Well, it seems like there's been an organized effort on somebody's part to really conceal the truth about the first Gulf War illness, and the fact that there are really so many young men and women who are really ill permanently. And certainly there have been some studies that have suggested there was something called squalene in many of the people who were ill. And perhaps you could tell our listeners what squalene is and why the finding of antibodies to squalene in these people who were ill was such a significant finding.
Well, the reason it was significant is that the squalene is not an approved chemical to put into vaccines, and that's where they probably got it. But it is in experimental vaccines, and there is some evidence that squalene was used in experimental vaccines and given to our forces who were deployed during the Gulf War, and that's probably why they had antibodies against squalene. But, of course, they would never admit that experimental vaccines were given that contained squalene. So the scientists that were involved in this, I think, came up against a stone wall eventually, because they couldn't really prove that these forces were given vaccines that contained squalene as an adjuvant. Now, an adjuvant is used to boost the immune system, and that's primarily what it's used for, but it's not an FDA-approved adjuvant, so it can only be used in experimental vaccines. And I know that the Pentagon did not want to admit that any experimental vaccines were given during the Gulf War, but I've seen copies, these rare copies of shot records from some of the soldiers that came back, and primarily these are from the medics and the corpsmen that served with the Army and the Marine Corps, and that were able to get some of the records before they disappeared or were destroyed. And they show evidence of experimental vaccines because they're coded. And normally the vaccines listed in an individual shot record are not coded. Anybody can figure out what those vaccines are just from the nomenclature. But these were unusual in that you couldn't really tell what they were.
And, of course, really, I think a lot of Americans would be very incensed to realize that the Department of Defense would use our fighting men for experiments, experimenting with their very lives and their health by giving them experimental vaccines. And so nobody wants to talk about that. Would that be a fair statement?
That would be a fair statement. But we've had several... for example, U.S. Marines, former Marines that came forward to us and told us about experimental programs that were being conducted at Camp Pendleton here in Southern California and at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego. In fact, two or three of these were rare survivors of some of these tests that resulted in whole platoons full of men becoming sick and being put in a prison ward at Balboa Naval Hospital where they couldn't leave, and then they were essentially being studied as guinea pigs for a while, and many of these evidently died. We don't know how many were involved in these studies. We don't know how many died from these studies, but it's interesting that one of the individuals that we assisted and helped him eventually get his medical records, even though they at first denied he was ever in the Marine Corps, and then they denied he was ever in an experimental unit, and then they denied he was never hospitalized at Balboa Naval Hospital, with the help of his congressman, he's living in Oregon now, he was able to actually recover his records. And lo and behold, the records, the medical records that he finally got, show that he was in an experimental group that was receiving some kind of experimental vaccines, although he could never really tell exactly what. And interestingly, I found the most interesting was the physician in charge of this unit turns out to be the same physician who's now in charge of all the Gulf War illness work at the Pentagon.
Well, that you can sort of put two and two together, and if you don't come up with four, you're in real trouble. But, of course, the trouble is so many of our servicemen are in trouble, and, of course, they have nobody there to speak in their behalf, and the government doesn't tell the truth. Government officials consistently stated over and over again none of our men who went to the first Gulf War were exposed to poison gas. And then they admitted, well, maybe 5,000, maybe 10,000, maybe 50,000. And what was the final figure they admitted? Was it 100, 150,000 of them were exposed to it?
Yes, so between 120 and 150,000.
And, of course, this was really because they had just sort of accidentally blown up a bunker full of poison gas. It was Iraqi poison gas, and we blew up the bunker. Well, you would think that somebody would have thought that if you blow up a bunker full of poison gas, you disseminate the poison gas. And we'll get back to that in just a moment here with Dr. Garth Nicholson. The incredible story of, well, we'll go from the Gulf War illness to some of the other illnesses that affect everybody in our population. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we've been talking about the Gulf War illness, and we're just beginning then to touch on the tragic blowing up of a bunker there in, I guess it was, whether it was Kuwait or southern Iraq, I'm not certain. But
well, it was the big bunker that people talk about is Kamisea.
Right.
That's the bunker where they did the airflow studies to show that wide areas of Kuwait and in southern Iraq were, in fact, exposed to blowback from the explosions destroying these bunkers. And the contents of the bunkers, many of the bunkers contained either chemical or biologic agents. And so these were dispersed via the air, and, of course, then exposed large numbers of our forces on the ground. But that wasn't the only incident that occurred, and some of these are just coming to light now, years later. When I think of that situation, I think also of the Marines that went through these chem bio minefields, where they had mines that were chemical mines or biological mines that when they hit them, they blew up, and then they put either poison gas or biologicals into the air. And they also had about 60 of these Italian-made biological weapon sprayers that were used to make exclusionary zones, or essentially biological minefields, in southern Kuwait and in southern Iraq. And you don't hear much about these, but there's a retired colonel from Fort Baker in Northern California, and he was actually the colonel who was in charge of developing the biologic detection device that they decided at the last minute would not be deployed to the Gulf War. So he's writing a book about his experiences there, and he's writing about these Italian-made biologic weapon sprayers. And so they had these biological and chemical agents that were fully deployed, and that's one thing that was never admitted by the Pentagon after the war, that there were chemical and biologic agents that were deployed during the war. And then there's the interesting case of the Scud B missile attacks. And I have some very good inside source from the Marine Corps. They were in charge of an area around Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, and we had an air defense system there. And the Iraqis were sending a lot of Scuds into that area, and they calculated about one-third of these were probably chem bio warheads that came in on the Scuds. And the reason for that is that they contained the chemical agent Prussian blue. And they put the Prussian blue in there to destroy the filters, the HEPA filters, and the gas masks. And so all the chemical and biological warheads contained Prussian blue. And of course, this became quite a scandal because the Iraqis obtained all of the Prussian blue from the United States of America, from a plant in Boca Raton, Florida, that made the Prussian blue for the Iraqi army. So, again, the United States Senate was able to document that these types of agents were transferred. They're called dual-use chemical and biologic agents that were transferred to the Iraqis well before the Gulf War, in fact, probably during the Iran-Iraq War. And so our own munitions probably got used against us during the first Gulf War.
But they've certainly kept that very secret from the American people.
Yes, they have, although there are documents in Congress, in the Congressional Record, indicating everything that essentially I've discussed tonight. Oh. So this is not something that has been totally kept quiet. It's just been avoided for the most part. The mainstream press has avoided it. Of course, the Congress has avoided it. There are a few committees that have met and discussed some of these things. I've testified myself to Congress several times about these sorts of things.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Nicholson was just saying that there apparently were some chemical and biological warfare scuds that were sent into Saudi Arabia, and the people there, of course, were well aware of this because these warheads, when they exploded, disseminated Prussian blue. Prussian blue was then used to block the gas masks of anybody in that area. In other words, the gas mask would not be effective. And, of course, the one reason that had to be suppressed was because the Prussian blue that the Saudis were using, pardon me, the Iraqis were using to attack America had come from American plants, and that would be embarrassing. And so so much of what really happened in the first Gulf War has been suppressed, kept from the American people by the media. Dr. Nichols had mentioned that he had actually testified before congressional committees on this sort of thing. The information is there, but How is the average Indica individual going to find it? How do you really find out what goes on in the congressional committees? Unless you have an outside source of information or know people who are actually there, it's impossible really to find out. You really have to go out of your way. And if you're not going to read about it in your newspaper or magazines, you're not going to hear about it on television or on the radio, why, for all intents and purposes, it didn't happen. And there is no way we can maintain a free society if the American people do not have access to this sort of information. So, of course, what were you testifying specifically about before Congress at that time?
Well, mostly our testimony was about the chronic illnesses in the Gulf War veterans. And also at other times we were testifying on what had been done to, in fact, treat and take care of these patients who had this unusual illness, which is related most closely to civilian illnesses such as chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome. So we might just go on into that topic. I would like to end up saying that we now know that there are over 6,000 of our deployed forces that have been returned from the theater of operations because of unusual and unknown illnesses.
Now, this is the current operation you're speaking
of. So we're going to see more casualties of this sort. And again, it may be related to the vaccines. It may be related to something else.
Well, now, do you think that depleted uranium played any part in the first Gulf War or in the second Gulf War, the one we're engaged in today? Is a depleted uranium intoxication a serious problem? Is it something that will give a long-term problems? Or what are your thoughts on depleted uranium?
Well, we just don't know. I mean, that's the bottom line with depleted uranium. For your listeners, if they wonder what is depleted uranium and why is it there, it's a very dense metal. And it's a byproduct of uranium processing. And although depleted uranium is depleted of a lot of the radioactive uranium, there's still quite a bit of radioactivity left in depleted uranium. And it's made into what are called penetrators, armor penetrators. And these sorts of munitions are designed to penetrate hard targets, such as armored vehicles, tanks, so on and so forth. And so that's why they're used. And they're mixed with the tungsten, and they're made into a very, very heavy metal. It's almost like a needle in its design. Fired at very high velocity, it hits a target, and it literally melts its way through the target because of the high temperature and the high kinetic energy in these penetrators when they hit a target. Now, the problem is that it's so hot, and when it burns its way through, it actually burns and forms into uranium oxide. Uranium oxide is a very, very, not dense, it's dense, but it's a fluffy material that goes up into the air and then slowly settles down like a fine dust on all the armored equipment where these penetrating munitions have hit. And then if you're in the area and you're moving around and kicking this stuff up, it will come up as this fine dust and it can be inhaled into the lungs. And here's where the problem starts. If you inhale these depleted uranium oxide particles in the lung, then you have a radioactive source that's actually in your lung, and it just doesn't leave your lungs. Eventually it's absorbed and it ends up in the bone. If it gets in the bone, of course, that's where our bone marrow produces the blood cells that we need in our body, and that could be really deleterious in the long run. We just don't know what the long-term effects of depleted uranium. It's probably not going to be the same as what we've seen with most of the casualties in the first Gulf War. But the long-term effects may occur 10, 20 years out.
And I think that's really the frightening thing, not only for the American casualties, but for the people of the Middle East. And where are we going to be 20 years from now? Where are the scientific studies that say that there will be no long-term health effects from this? And, of course, I don't think that the people in the military really want those studies because, why, if we found that it was dangerous, why, they'd have to stop using this, and this is a very effective tool. And, of course, as Rush Limbaugh said, and one of the things I agree with, he said the purpose of the military is to kill people and destroy things, and I think depleted uranium is a very, very effective weapon. We'll be right back. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we were going to get on into the subject then of fibromyalgia, and of course we'll just have to wait and see. The stories of depleted uranium, we'll probably one day we'll know just how dangerous it is. But what about fibromyalgia, and where does that fit into the spectrum of Gulf War illness, chronic fatigue syndrome, and then this relatively new entity, because I don't remember the entity of fibromyalgia when I was going to medical school.
Well, there were probably some cases of it, but nowhere near the numbers that we're seeing now. The numbers are skyrocketing of these, unusual chronic illnesses that we see these days, and we just didn't see that much of it 20, 30 years ago. Now we're seeing much more of it. In fact, when we first started studying Gulf War illnesses, in the first 600 or 700 veterans that we studied, we compiled a list of their signs and symptoms and their severity and so on and so forth. And then we started comparing it to various other types of illnesses. And of course, what came out was that they were most similar to chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome. So one of the first papers actually that we published in an environmental medical journal was the fact that the signs and symptoms were highly overlapping with this. So the Gulf War illness is really a chronic fatiguing illness, if you had to put it in a category of illness. So then we found the chronic infections in many of these Gulf War veterans and decided that, well, maybe this could be part of the etiology of the civilian illnesses that were very similar. And in fact, we found in other laboratories after us found very similar types of infections. And the difference was that we found primarily one type of infection in the Gulf War veterans, this Mycoplasma fermentans that we mentioned before. And we found a lot of mycoplasmal infections in the civilians, but we found that they could be a half a dozen different species of mycoplasma. Mycoplasma pneumoniae, in fact, was the most common one that we found in American patients. European patients, it turns out, have a different distribution of these chronic infections. For example, in Europe, the most common mycoplasma infection was Mycoplasma hominis, when we studied a group of Dutch and Belgian patients with two of the universities over in Europe. So, in fact, there are similar types of infections in these chronic illness patients who are civilians who never went near the Gulf War. And I hear this all the time, that people tell me, well, how can I have the same signs and symptoms as somebody that served in the Gulf War? Well, you can if you have a similar type of infection that we found in the Gulf War veterans. You can come down with a very similar type of illness. And so over half of the patients...
Hold that thought right there, please, for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and he was just saying that they found in so many of the patients that studied with fibromyalgia, these were the patients coming back from the first Gulf War, that they were infected with a mycoplasma fermentans. And then, of course, when they'd studied people in Europe, working with the physicians in Europe, we found that many of these people had mycoplasma infections too, but they were a different type, in other words, a different type of mycoplasma. And hominis and pneumonia?
The most common mycoplasmal infection that we found in European chronic fatigue syndrome patients was Mycoplasma hominis. And in contrast, the most common mycoplasma in American, in North American, Canadian, and American patients was Mycoplasma pneumoniae, which is a different type of mycoplasma. They cause overlapping signs and symptoms, very similar, a little bit different. But so these are illnesses which we think either were caused, or at least the infection plays a role as either a co-causing illness or exacerbates the illness. And when we started looking at the chronic fatigue syndrome patients, as an example, and the fibromyalgia syndrome patients, we found that the patients that had been ill the longest always had multiple infections. So they could have multiple bacterial and viral infections. And one of the common viral infections found was a herpes virus called HHV6. And also a few of them had cytomegaloviruses. So these were the common viruses that we found in these types of patients. And the common bacteria that we found were, of course, the mycoplasma. But we also found chlamydia pneumoniae, And in some of these patients that had chronic fatigue syndrome actually had the Lyme's disease causing Borrelia, the spirochete. All these bacterial infections that we found in these patients were intracellular. That is, they hid deep inside the tissues and deep inside the cells. And because of that, they probably didn't elicit a very strong immune response. So you didn't really see a strong set of antibodies against these types of infections. And this has confused physicians ever since the first Lyme disease outbreak in old Lyme, Connecticut, because it's very difficult to diagnose Lyme on the basis of these types of blood tests.
And of course, the Lyme disease is actually produced by a spirochete, isn't it? That's a different type of organism.
Yes, it is. But Lyme disease is actually a very common illness, and we've studied some of these patients ourselves and some of our colleagues back east as well. And most of these patients, about 65 to 70% of them, also have mycoplasmal infections. So we think that most of these patients have a co-infection situation. They have the Borrelia, but they also have mycoplasma. And then there are at least two other bacteria that are commonly found in these types of patients as well. And they can have, for example, Ehrlichia infections, Babesia infections, other types of infections. So they can have a number of infections. In fact, most Lyme patients do have a number of infections. They don't just have the one spirochete infection.
Well, now, of course, just a little off the subject, but we hear a lot of people with MS, multiple sclerosis, claiming that they've been diagnosed with Lyme disease. Is the relationship between Lyme disease and this MS type of syndrome that people get for the progressive neurological problems?
Well, we think there is, and we think there's a relationship not only with the Lyme spirochete, but also with the mycoplasma as well. And over 50%, for example, of MS patients have mycoplasmal infections. And there's a very high percentage of Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, that have mycoplasmal infections. It can be, and for example, in the Gulf War veterans, in our study, 100% of them had mycoplasma fermentans. We found a couple in Australia that had mycoplasma genitalium, which is very unusual for a systemic mycoplasma. But in the civilians that we looked at, they also had mycoplasmal infections that had Lou Gehrig's disease, but there we only found about 85% of the patients, not 100% of them, had these infections. So we think this type of infection is important in the disease process. We're not exactly sure what it does to the patient. Types of infections can cause cell death. If they get in the central nervous system, they can cause the nerve cells to die. And if they get in the right the central nervous system that controls the motor neurons, you can have a situation where these types of infections will mimic Lou Gehrig's disease and mimic MS and other neurologic diseases.
Well, now, of course, do you ever find the combination then of the Lyme disease and the mycoplasma together? The same person would have both infections?
Most do.
In other words, most of the many of the patients then who are diagnosed with Lyme disease actually would have a superimposed mycoplasma infection?
That's correct. And in fact, it's a very common situation where they have the Borrelia, the Lyme disease, the spirochete, and then they also have mycoplasma. And interestingly enough, the mycoplasma that comes up the most often is mycoplasma fermentans. And of course, that is really a quite different situation than we see in most civilians that have co-infections with mycoplasma. You don't expect to see that high a percentage of mycoplasma fermentans. So, again, this is a little piece of information that, in my own mind, is a little bit suspicious, and it may go back to the actual origin of the Lyme disease and where it actually came from.
Well, now, of course, will these patients, because one of the most horrible diseases I know is ALS. I mean, fairly young people will get this disease, and they almost die before your eyes. Progressive paralysis gets in the bulbar area. They can't swallow. They can't speak. And then, of course, they'll tend to choke, can't breathe. Will some of these respond to massive antibiotic treatment over a period of time?
We did a small pilot study, and unfortunately we just didn't have the funds to continue this, but it was really only done for 8 weeks, which is not nearly long enough, where patients were given intravenous antibiotics, and they were also given an antiviral as well, because we've, in working with some other scientists at our institute, we found viral infections in these patients as well as bacterial infections. And so we were trying to treat both. And many of these patients actually did much better. Unfortunately, after the study was terminated, within a month or two, they started progressing again. And I think that was pretty obvious that they hadn't been treated long enough. But we had some very dramatic changes in these patients. Some patients who couldn't speak regained the ability to speak. For example, the patients who couldn't walk, they were wheelchair-bound, regained the ability to walk, and so on. So some of those changes were pretty dramatic. And, of course, the patients that were the most progressed probably had the most cell death, and they responded the least. But the patients that were fairly early onset patients did extremely well.
Well, is there anybody out there who is treating these sort of patients with long-term antibiotics and clinically actually doing that, you know, just empirically?
Yes, there are. In fact, most of these are overseas. There are a number of patients in Norway that are being treated with this type of protocol. And there are some patients in Australia that are being treated in various places. And usually it's because of certain neurologists in these locations have been interested in the findings that probably that we published and in the work that people have heard about, mainly posted on our website, www.immed.org, like a media.org. And they read about some of the information that we've, working with the ALS patients and so on, and so they wanted to try it with their own patients, because there are very few options with ALS patients. There's literally nothing a neurologist can offer that has any lasting benefit to these patients, so they're desperate to find something. And, of course, the patients themselves were very desperate to find anything that could help them. And so there are some patients that are being treated with these protocols now.
Do we have any idea how they're doing, or is it too early to determine?
I think it's probably too early to determine, and it's mostly done on a case-by-case basis, and I don't always get the feedback on how they're doing. Obviously, we're just at the initial stages of this, and so we need to do really a lot more work than we're doing. It's very piecemeal at the moment.
Would they use something like Rocephin, and then what sort of broad-spectrum antibiotics would they use?
Well, they were actually, to treat the viral infections, and one of the infections that we and others had found in these patients was a kind of an unusual virus. In our case, it was an Echo 7 virus that we found in these patients. These types of viruses are not commonly found, but they are neurotrophic viruses, that is, viruses that more or less home to the central nervous system and cause problems there. These types of viruses have been related to neurologic problems, and I think the combination of the virus plus the bacteria sets up a situation where if it isn't ALS, it certainly mimics ALS to the point where neurologists can't tell the difference between them. So the patients that have these infections, and most do, we figured would be quite susceptible to antibiotic and antiviral treatment. And so that's what we designed our protocols to do. Instead of using antivirals, we used kind of a broad spectrum treatment, which was a derivative of vitamin C, a derivative that would penetrate into the central nervous system. It's called dibenzylated vitamin C. And that proved to be fairly effective in suppressing the Echo 7 virus. I don't know how it is against other types of viruses, but at least against the Echo 7, it was effective. And we put that in with antibiotics like doxycycline and ciprofloxacin. And these patients actually did pretty well on that type of regimen.
All right, fine. And we're just giving it on a daily basis?
Yes, it had to be given on a daily basis, and these were intravenous treatments, so it was not really very conducive to studies done, out in the community or at home or something. It had to be done in a clinical setting. And, of course, that limited our ability to do that, because these types of studies are extremely expensive.
I'm sure they are, and it's really tragic that they're not the funding out there that will actually help these people. Because is ALS becoming more frequent, do you think, as MS and ALS? For our listeners out there, that's anterior lateral sclerosis, which is, of course, Lou Gehrig's disease. And then, of course, MS is multiple sclerosis. Are these increasing in frequency, or are they staying fairly stable?
No, they're actually increasing in frequency, and if they were just genetic-based diseases, one would not expect that. So we think that there's another piece of evidence that there's something else involved than just genetics, although these diseases are rare enough where you expect that there is some genetic susceptibility pattern that we just don't understand that goes on, because why would a patient, let's say, get these infections? Why would a patient come down with one patient come down with MS, another patient come down with ALS, and share some common infections? And so the explanation for that is that there's a different genetic background, and there's a different susceptibility to these various agents, and a different physiology in these individuals. And so that's why that can happen. But this sets up a tremendous dilemma in dealing with the infectious disease specialists around the country, because they've been trained in medical school, and I know this because for 30 years I taught in medical school, so have you, that infectious disease specialists are trained that if you have one infection, like poliovirus, that leads to a disease called polio, and that you can't have all these different types of infections causing all these different diseases. But I think you can, depending upon the genetic background and the immunology and where these infections reside in the system and so on, that can cause a number of different problems. So we have to relook, we have to take another look, a fresh look, at the way we train physicians in this country, particularly in terms of these types of chronic infections.
Well, do you think there are other things like external toxins that might have an effect on this? In other words, might predispose the people to coming down with these diseases? Or some people feel that things like a NutraSweet, which consists of aspartic acid and methadol and phenylalanine, is widely used in this country, and there are stories that many times people will get off their aspartame and they will actually improve as far as their neurological condition is concerned. So could that predispose people to make them more susceptible to the infections?
Absolutely. Things like heavy metal exposures, for example, in our advanced industrial societies, there are a lot of people walking around that have heavy metal exposures and don't even realize it. Things like toxic chemicals, and again, in the workplace, we're often exposed to toxic chemicals, even in the home, and so on. And so these things tend to accumulate in your body, and they can, with time, and along with other things like infections and so on, cause a very complex scenario. And of course, because these illnesses are so complex in determining their etiology, that means that it's very hard to determine exactly what caused the disease in any one patient.
Well, I think it's so vitally important, and I just wish the facilities and the funding available to really follow through, because certainly ALS, I know several people have died with it, and they're usually such young people and with a whole life ahead of them, and then this progressive neurological disease. Well, now let's get back, of course, to the chronic fatigue syndrome, because we sort of got off of that in the fibromyalgia. Certainly, this is an extremely common disease today, and you've actually found that many of these people actually have a mycoplasma infection?
Yes, between 50% and 60% of them do. From our studies, and these have been duplicated by other laboratories around the country and in fact in different areas around the world. So we know that many of these patients have, at least in the case of mycoplasma infections, 50 or 60% of them have that. And then there's some that have viral infections as well, some that have other types of infections. And again, it's very dependent upon the location. For example, we found the rural areas of the United States that many of the chronic fatigue syndrome patients in the rural areas, particularly livestock areas, actually had brucella infections, causing a kind of a chronic brucellosis. And brucella, and then if you got a mycoplasma infection on top of the brucella, instead of a mild brucellosis, you ended up with chronic fatigue syndrome, because many of those patients had chronic fatigue syndrome. You didn't see this so much in the cities as in the rural areas. So again, there were differences. Regional differences are probably important. Environmental differences are probably important. Exposure to other toxic materials like heavy metals or chemicals and so on, also very important. So these patients are not easily put into different categories, and that's part of the problem dealing with these chronic illnesses. The patients tend to be a very heterogeneous group of patients, and they have different sets of problems and so on. And it's awfully hard when you're just talking about chronic fatigue syndrome to say that these are all the same types of patients, because they're not. So we tend to try, at least myself, I try and categorize these in terms of, are these the patients that have chronic infections that are important, or are these the patients that have chemical exposures that are important, or heavy metal exposures that are important, and so on.
And so it can be sort of a cross-section. They can have several of them then that would be playing a part in this.
Absolutely. In fact, that's just what you find.
And of course, I think that for our listeners out there, you have to realize that there, I think it's acknowledged, 800,000 people in America who have chronic fatigue syndrome today. And of course, we get reports from Europe. They've got problems all throughout Europe. And this is a relatively new disease. Maybe it existed in some form when I was going to medical school, but certainly it's much, much more prevalent now than ever before. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up this first hour's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson from IMMED.org. That's the Institute for Molecular Medicine, IMMED.org, and certainly one of the world's leading experts on the subject we're talking about. In fact, what's so interesting is every time I have Dr. Nicholson on, I get an email from somebody over in the Netherlands, I think it is, and they ask if they can post our interview on their website. So they certainly apparently have a real problem with that over in Europe as well as here. Have you run into the talking to people over there?
Oh, yes. I get a lot of emails from Europe, particularly from Scandinavia, from the lowland countries, from Belgium, from the Netherlands, for example, are very common.
And of course, a lot of what people have is chronic fatigue syndrome. They're just emotionally and physically wiped out. They just can't be productive. And you know, here if you're a wage earner, why, of course, you can't support your family. And of course, everybody thinks you're crazy. This is one of the big problems. Is since there's no real test for this, all you have is really the subjective symptoms. But I mean, they seem to be so consistent. This is a very real entity. Now, a lot of these people will have intestinal problems, won't they? Diarrhea, as well as the memory loss and the chronic fatigue and the headaches and the ache all over. And isn't this pretty much of a consistent syndrome?
Well, two of the more commonly found problems, signs and symptoms that you see in the chronic fatigue syndrome patients are bowel problems, mostly something like irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel syndrome. Also rheumatic problems like aching joints and stiffness, like rheumatoid arthritis. So these are two of the common, but there are other things as well that overlap. And so this is why we were so interested in looking at chronic infections, because in both those conditions, the inflammatory bowel disease, for example, IBS, and also rheumatoid arthritis, there's a very high percentage of those patients that have these types of chronic bacterial and viral infections. And so we think that these play a role in a variety of different disease states in humans and also in animals. These types of infections will cause very similar types of problems in barnyard animals, for example, and so it is a problem in livestock, these types of infections as well, and so on. And so it leads to a lot of antibiotic treatment of livestock and so on. And so this is, again, one of the economic problems in certain areas of the country where if these infections get out of hand, they can cause a real problem in livestock. So it's not just humans that have a problem with these illnesses.
Hold that thought right there. We're going to have to bring our stations back on. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. And, of course, our guest for this first hour has been Dr. Garth Nicholson of the Institute on Molecular Medicine, and you want to go to their website, and I recommend it to you. If you know anybody who has these diseases, it's IMMED.org. And Dr. Nicholson is certainly one of the world's leading experts in this field, and he's testified many times before the various departments of government, and has worked certainly with many of the people who had these diseases, especially the Gulf War illnesses. So anyway, if you'd like to get more information on that, we do have an excellent four-tape set on chronic fatigue syndrome. We carry a book called Osler's Web. It's written by Hillary Johnson. It's the story of the chronic fatigue syndrome and how it first occurred, starting really first described up in Lake Tahoe with a small cluster there, and then clusters of this appeared all throughout the world, which would suggest there was an infectious origin. You see clusters, a small group of people with the same disease, you see, think they're either being poisoned with the same thing or they have the same organism. I will tell you that this book, Oxler's Web, and we only have a few of them left, but it is one of the most intriguing books because it reads like a mystery story. And when the three or four we have are gone, I don't know whether we'll get any more of them in. But Hilary Johnson's Oxler's Web is an excellent book. We recommend it to you. If you have chronic fatigue, if you know somebody who has chronic fatigue, and of course you'd like to have some idea of what they're going through, and then of course the doctors who've tried to treat this, who've tried to, you know, to figure out what was wrong with their patients and treat them, and of course many times they've been sorely criticized, everybody's saying these patients are crazy. They're not crazy at all, they're ill, and it's simply because people do not understand what's really wrong with them, and they're being ostracized in the same way the Gulf War veterans were ostracized for 10 years, saying there's nothing there. Well, I believe there is something there, and I really seriously question why people at the Centers for Disease Control now have steadfastly insisted that there is no disease, it's all psychological. So the book Oxler's Web, we have a great four tapes on chronic fatigue syndrome. We have a great four tapes out on the Gulf War syndrome. And all of these, of course, are efforts to educate people about these various conditions that you're not going to find widely described. So if you'd like more information, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's the four tapes out on chronic fatigue, the four tapes out on Gulf War syndrome, and then the book Oxler's Web by Hilary Johnson. So then, of course, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. We hope that you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can hear our program there 5 hours a day on the Internet and really not get much of anything accomplished. But there are many people who do listen on a regular basis, and some of the programs may be repetitive, but then sometimes repetition helps me to remember. I know it helps me to remember. Once I've done interviews with a person two or three times, I can really begin to remember exactly what they've said. Now, this program will not be repeated, so this is one of a kind. If you'd like to get copies of this program, of course, you can call us at 1-800-544-8927. But please tell others about our programs, not only on the Internet at radioliberty.com or at americanewsnet.com or gcnlive.com or rbnlive.com or soundwave2000.com. All of their carrying our programs on the Internet. And then, of course, we would also suggest that you tell others about our shortwave broadcast, 4 hours a day, our satellite broadcast, 5 hours a day, and certainly they can listen to us on radio stations somewhere in America 5 hours every day. So we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because I really believe that behind much of what's going on today, there are powerful spiritual forces at work. Then we ask you to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow evening, I guess it'll be Thursday evening now, when we'll be back with you once again. This is Dr. Stan. Good night, and may the Lord be with you. Dale, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, tonight we didn't take any callers the first hour, and we probably won't take any in the first half hour or the second hour. We'll see how things go, because there's so much that needs to be covered, and I don't want to get distracted by getting off on side issues. But our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson, who, of course, was a professor, worked in medical school and for 30 years in Texas, MB Anderson Clinic there, and then, of course, he came to California. He is the scientific on the scientific advisory board of a number of medical journals, and last thing I heard, you actually edited two of them. Do you still edit those, Dr. Nicholson?
Yes, I do, although one of these, I'm giving up my editorship beginning next year.
All right, fine. That takes an awful lot of time. You have to get, of course, the articles out to people and have them peer review them. But anyway, certainly he is an expert in the field that we're talking about, and I've talked to many of his people who work with him and his residents who trained with him, and of course, there's no question that he knows exactly what he's talking about, and we're so fortunate to have him with us here. Now as we, of course, turn on our television almost every night, we hear about the threat of influenza and how everybody has to get their influenza shots and how there's a shortage of influenza shots, and if you're really lucky, why, you might be able to get one. And then we hear about the threat of this new disease that's over in, I believe it's in Thailand, somewhere over there. And of course, some people have contracted the disease from ducks, and of course, this is the deadly new form of disease. And we seem to be seeing all sorts of new diseases that are jumping the species barrier, which diseases haven't done in centuries past, have they?
Well, there is good evidence that many of the diseases do jump or can jump from one species to another, but it's not the usual situation. The usual situation is that these infections, if they cause disease, usually evolve and specialize in one species, and so it you don't see it in other species unless they're closely related. That's not what we see, however, in some of these illnesses or some of these infections that we found commonly in chronic illnesses. They do seem to be capable of jumping to other species, and they're also carried by other species as vectors as well. And so they can be born, for example, by insects, or they could be carried in animals, for example, and end up an airborne infection. Those animals can cough, and then humans can pick it up, and vice versa. So I think we're seeing more of that, or at least we're now recognizing it more.
Well, of course, we had last year, we had the SARS epidemic. That was sort of a bizarre type of organism, and did get a few cases here in the United States, a few cases in Canada, apparently a fair number of cases in Canada. It seemed to be more over though in China and Hong Kong and that area. And now the SARS really has more or less disappeared, hasn't it?
Well, it's still around, and it's still festering in China, and we could see further outbreaks of SARS again, and so there's quite a bit of work going on in trying to develop some new vaccines against SARS to prevent it from spreading. It's interesting that we were in contact with some of the Canadian healthcare facilities in Ontario province in Canada, where they had a major outbreak in the Toronto area, for example, of SARS, and we advised them that the secondary infections, particularly mycoplasmal infections, are very important in SARS, and not to forget to treat with antibiotics as well. And so they were actually getting pretty good results with that type of protocol.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Garth Nicholson, and pointing out that these can be in combined viral and, of course, mycoplasma infections.
And actually more chlamydia pneumonia.
Well, Dr. Stan here and Dr. Garth Nicholson is our guest, and he was saying that this would appear to be more chlamydia. And chlamydia, that's really a bacterial infection, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's also a type of bacteria that can become intracellular and cause a lot of problems in our systems. And in fact, probably 10% or so of chronic fatigue syndrome patients have chlamydia pneumonia infections.
Well, Chris, when I went to medical school 50-some years ago, an awful long time ago, we didn't even recognize that chlamydia is a serious infection. Do you think it's always been here? Is it much more prevalent in recent decades?
Well, I'm not sure, because widespread testing for this type of bacterial infection has not really occurred until the last few years, so it's hard to say. I think some of these infections have been around for a while. Some of them may have gotten worse in the meantime, and others have combined with other types of infections to cause situations that I think are clinically different from what we've seen before. And some of the chronic illnesses like chronic fatigue syndrome and so on may fall in this category because of the combination of different infections that are found in these patients, and that may be a bit unique.
All right, fine. But anyway, of course, the SARS people did, of course, respond quite well then with the added antibiotics to whatever else. Was there any specific viral treatment at all for the SARS, or was it something you just had to ride out?
Well, there were viral treatments that are used with SARS to various varying degrees of effectiveness. And in fact, they're still working on the best protocols to treat SARS. And one of the things, of course, that we need in the our armament against SARS is a decent vaccine. And so that's where the work is going on right now, trying to develop a vaccine against it so that we can immunize people in areas where there's a SARS outbreak.
Well, now, one of the things that we always hear about, talking about the Spanish flu that occurred back in 1918, that killed about 20 million people throughout the world, and, of course, really more people, almost as many people died of that terrible epidemic as died during the Second World War. There are about 20 million deaths all told, including the about 12 million military, and, of course, the rest were civilians. But and then, of course, we're told that this could come back at any time. Is there any relationship between the Spanish flu, or the similarity of the construction of the Spanish flu, to what we're seeing with this new disease, this new type of influenza over in Thailand?
Well, I'm not sure. I really haven't studied any reports on the genetic similarities between the new types of flu. The new types of influenza.
I'm sorry, I've got to interrupt you. We've got to bring our stations right back on. Here they come. Well, Dr. Stan, I guess this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we were just asking if there's any relationship between the genetic makeup of the Spanish flu, which, of course, swept the world back in 1918 with devastating results because there weren't any antibiotics, and 20 million people died, as many people as died as a result of the Second World War, died as a result of the epidemic. And I was simply asking if there's any similarity between the influenza virus that existed at that time. We know what it was because they've gone up to the permafrost and dug up some of the bodies and were able to identify the genetic makeup of that virus. And of course, what we're seeing in Thailand today, and I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I have no control over the board. Please go right ahead.
Okay. Well, what I was going to tell you is that some of the newer cases of influenza are actually a similar disease, a para-influenza. And these are the fowl flu, as they call them, diseases that are coming out now in Asia and infecting humans. And this is something that's fairly recent, because I don't recall, at least in my training, para-influenzas like the ones that cause problems in fowl, like Newcastle disease and so on, which can wipe out herds of fowl and nothing flat, infecting humans. But now all of a sudden you're finding that some of these fowl para-influenza viruses are actually capable of infecting humans, and so some of the outbreaks that they've seen are actually due to these para-influenza viruses instead of the influenza viruses. So we are seeing some of this spreading into different species.
And really, that's a little frightening because, of course, if we would have another massive, epidemic as they've had before, ordinarily the regular influenza, is not that deadly. Certainly, some people will die, especially if they have a compromised immune system, and then maybe they'll be more susceptible to getting other infections as well, true pneumonia or other things that can be lethal for them. There are all sorts of figures they put out. 30 people die every year, 30,000 people die every year of influenza. I'm not quite certain how they come up with those figures, are you?
No, I'm not. And in fact, those are, I think, worldwide figures that they've come up with, and I think they're primarily estimates rather than actual figures. It's pretty hard to get those kind of figures from most areas around the world.
Okay, so, but of course, I personally don't take the influenza shots. I just have been a little skeptical of and worried about it. I've never taken them. And, of course, what is the incidence of, say, the complication of Guillain-Barré disease after taking the influenza shots?
Well, I'm not sure the exact incidence rate of that, but it is a potential side effect or problem with these types of vaccines. And so, in fact, they really, in my own mind, should really only be given to patients that are at high risk, and these would be elderly patients and so on.
Well, now, what about this idea? They're saying, well, we should give it to every child who's 6 months old, because, of course, we want to protect those children. But it seems to me that you're dealing with a child with immature immunological development, a child with an immature brain, and, of course, my understanding is there's thimerosal in those vaccines, and that's an awfully small child for giving a very, very potent vaccine to. Would you feel that's a problem, or do you think that's a good idea?
I really don't think it's a good idea, and the reason for that is that we've seen such an explosive increase in autism and attention deficit disorder in children that have been immunized with these multiple vaccines. And although we've seen such a tremendous amount of government propaganda saying that the vaccines don't cause these types of childhood illnesses, in fact, usually they study it one vaccine at a time and say that, well, you can't trace these types of illnesses to one vaccine, such as the mumps types of vaccines, the tri-vaccine, and so on. But the problem is that there's no study that I know of which puts all the 20 to 30 vaccines together and studies that as a group of vaccines, because I think it's the overall effect of these multiple vaccines, just like we found in the Gulf War, that the multiple vaccines, the 20 or 30 vaccines that were given during a deployment during the first Gulf War, which caused tremendous immunosuppression in those deployed forces, and I think made them very susceptible to either minor contaminants in the vaccine or vaccines or other contaminants that they came in contact with in the environment.
And I think that's really so interesting. We ordinarily think of vaccines as increasing your immunity, but you're suggesting that when you take multiple vaccines, it can actually decrease your immune response?
Yes, you simply overload the system. And so there's been a rush to put more and more of these vaccines together and to truncate the protocol for giving vaccines, so they're given closer together and in earlier ages. And I don't think this is a good strategy. I really don't.
Well, I share your concern. And my thought is they certainly should do some extensive experiments before we experiment on the entire population. And in many respects, certainly the giving of the hepatitis B to infants in the nursery, the first year of life, the first few days of life, when we don't have any long-range follow-ups on that, I just don't understand the rationale.
I don't either. As a matter of fact, this is one thing that's under intense discussion, particularly by some of these patient support groups and also research groups that deal with things like autism and attention deficit disorder and these childhood illnesses. You just look at the data and it smacks that there's something wrong. Take a country like Norway, for example. Before they instituted the widespread use of these vaccines, before school-age children went to school, they had very little autism and attention deficit disorder. Now it's just skyrocketing in incidence after the government has actually forced the population to take these vaccines at an early age. So although they can't pin it down to any one vaccine, that does not mean that the multiple vaccines are causing the problem.
And I certainly share your concern. I would think that the people over there would rise up in their righteous indignation and say we're not going to do it. But apparently people in most countries are much more subservient than the independents we see here in America.
Well, there are still, there is still the chance of Americans avoiding this type of situation, either because of religious preferences or because of other reasons. It's like being a conscientious objector in a way, you know, that you should not have to be forced into the situation where you have to, as a child, to take all these vaccines, particularly against your will and against your parents' will. And it's one of these public health concerns that they want to make sure that 100% of the population has been immunized. And in fact, you don't need to have 100% immunized to protect the population against these types of illnesses. And I sort of wonder now that they've tried to put more and more vaccines into the mix given to these young children, whether this is just causing the problem instead of solving it.
I share your concern. We've got somebody calling in here. Who do we have on the line?
Darren Howard from San Antonio.
Okay, fine. Go ahead. Would you have a question for the doctor? Go ahead.
For your guest, were you aware that the Army is basically put out to tell the medical centers with these soldiers coming back from Iraq not to look for depleted uranium?
Oh, yes. They're not supposed to look for depleted uranium, and they're not supposed to look for mycoplasmal infections. These are two things that are on the list of not to do.
In other words, why would you put out a directive not to look for things? I would think that you would want to do everything you could to find out what's going on, because my understanding is that there are about 30,000, at least this was about 3 weeks ago, about 30,000 young men have come back from the war, about 6,000 of them are wounded, but the rest of them, they have these diseases, and they're not quite sure what's wrong with them.
Because the Army Medical Center here was doing that. The first thing they looked for was depleted uranium in the shrapnel, and try to remove all the shrapnel, especially depleted uranium. But that was the first thing they looked for. But then they were given a directive: you are not to look for depleted uranium.
All right. Well, I think that is very, very revealing.
Isn't that really bad, Dr. Stan?
Thanks so much, Howard. I'm glad you brought that subject up. God bless.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
God bless, too.
Okay. Now, you had heard of this from other sources, then, besides Howard?
Yes. And, again, I have no way to follow up on this and to actually check it out. But, yes, we'd heard that not only are they purposely not looking for depleted uranium, but they're purposely not looking for some of these chronic infections like mycoplasmal infections.
And, of course, they had actually done this extensive study in the Veterans Administration. And, of course, it would appear that the study was designed, as so many other studies have been designed, to come up with a specific preconceived notion. Now, scientific studies are supposed to, be impartial and not to slant the results, because science is the search for truth. But sometimes, unfortunately, in today's atmosphere of why, of course, political expediency seems to trump any effort really to get to the bottom of this, because the implications of if these veterans are really infected, they really do have a treatable disease, why think of the liability as far as our government is concerned. Here's another 150,000 people they're going to have to pay a disability to.
Well, that's true if they give them a disability rating. The problem is that they've been trying not to give them disability ratings, or if they give them a rating, they try and keep it down around 10 to 20%. And, of course, as you know from the military, that means nothing in terms of getting compensation for anything that you've been disabled by in the military.
Well, I think if you've gone overseas to fight for your country and you come back disabled, I think it behooves the government and all the citizens to look after you. And the men who are courageous enough to fight for America, I think, should be taken care of if they become victims of war. And whatever the cause may be, if it's directly service-related, it should be certainly compensated. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Dr. Garth Nicholson. And, of course, we will welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 and far as I'm concerned, Dr. Nicholson is certainly one of the world's leading experts on chronic fatigue disease, fibromyalgia, and these other bizarre disease infections which plague so many people across America today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we've been talking this evening about the Gulf War illness, about the fact that the chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia seem to be almost spectrums along with Gulf illness of the same illness. And one of the things I wanted to ask about was the AIDS epidemic, which, of course, we don't hear that much about in America today, but about 40,000 people are dying every year here in America today of this terrible, terrible disease. And of course, one of the things that has been brought out is that literally all of these people, in addition to having the HIV viral infection, have a mycoplasm. Now, is that a specific type of mycoplasm? In other words, is it the same mycoplasm fermentans, or is it any one of this whole gamut of mycoplasms?
Well, it can be any one of the whole gamut, although there's a very high percentage that have the mycoplasm fermentans. In fact, there's a group in France that claims that this type of infection is actually a cofactor in the whole AIDS syndrome when it develops. That is, you don't really get a full-blown AIDS syndrome unless you have this co-infection. And I'm not sure if that's true or not, but it certainly makes sense from what we know about the AIDS virus, because the AIDS virus itself doesn't really cause disease. It causes depletion of the immune cells, and that leads to opportunistic infections, which are what really kill people that have AIDS.
Okay, well, we've got Maria calling from Santa Cruz, and Maria apparently has fibromyalgia. Hi, Maria, how are you doing?
I'm okay, I have chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, and I have a couple of questions.
Okay, just speak right up now.
Okay, sorry. I have a question about long-term antibiotics. I know you've recommended if there is like a mycoplasma infection. But I heard on the news that it increases your risk of breast cancer, and because of my family history and other risk factors, that would be a concern to me. But I'm wondering about other options. I read about an MD who recommended IV hydrogen peroxide, which he said would kill not only like bacteria but virus and yeast, and I'm wondering if you think that's safe and effective.
All right, fine. First of all, the issue of taking long-term antibiotics for chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia.
Well,
what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think she was asking about the cancer incidence, and I think it's kind of been misquoted in the press. It's actually the patients that used heavy users of antibiotics were the ones which were associated with breast cancer. And that brings up another issue. If they had heavy antibiotic use, they must have had it for a reason, and that's because they had these chronic infections. And the real question should have been, what's the relationship between these chronic infections and cancers, not so much the antibiotic use? And in fact, that was the question that was never really asked. And one of the interesting studies that we did before we left Houston was that we studied two types of cancers, breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And we asked the question, what's the relationship between the rapidly killing types of cancer and these chronic infections? And what we found, and now other people have found as well and published on this, is that the patients that got cancer and died very quickly, they progressed very fast and died very quickly, inevitably those were the patients that had the same types of chronic infections that we've been discussing this evening. And if they survived even with the same stage of cancer, those were patients that didn't have the infection. So we feel that these infections, which can cause genetic mutations and changes in our cells when they're present, cause progression of cancer. If cancer is present, that's a really bad danger sign to have these infections along with it. So that's something that the study should have looked at.
Hold that thought right for a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we had Maria calling in from Santa Cruz, who has chronic fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome, and of course she was concerned about the possibility of using antibiotics to treat the chronic fatigue syndrome, saying that she'd read about an article about a study that had showed that long-term use of antibiotics can lead to cancer. Dr. Nicholson's response was, well, of course, is it the antibiotics that leads to the cancer? Is it the fact that they took the antibiotics because they had these other infections, and it was the other infections that predisposed the people to the cancer, that the two went together, rather the antibiotics producing it. It was the chronic infections that created the cancer, or at least aggravated the tendency of the individual to have cancer. Is that a fair appraisal of your remarks, sir?
Yes, except for one thing, is that we're not sure if these infections actually cause cancer, or if they simply exacerbate it or cause the progression of cancer. When in our studies, it looks like it's more the latter, is that these infections may not cause the cancer, but they can cause the progression of cancer. That is, they can make the cancer either grow faster or make it more dangerous, more malignant, and more likely to kill.
All right. And then, of course, Maria's second question was, what about the idea of intravenous hydrogen peroxide? Is there any place for that sort of treatment?
Well, this has been used, and it's a very effective tool. For example, in the clinics that we help support in Africa, it's one of the tools that are being used in the AIDS pandemic. The problem with it is that it has to be done under strict supervision. Very few people know how to do this correctly, and it requires using an incredibly low concentration of hydrogen peroxide and then building it up very slowly. And if you don't do that, you really could cause an overdose of that. It caused very dangerous side effects in patients. And in fact, this is one of the reasons why I think the AMA looks kind of askance at the use of intravenous ozone and hydrogen peroxide, because of the chance of adverse reactions because of it. And that's certainly true if it's not done carefully.
Well, does it seem to be beneficial with the patients that are getting this sort of treatment in Africa?
Yes, it is, but again, it has to be used in the way that I mentioned. It has to be done under situations, very controlled situations, where they're given very, very low doses, and then it's built up slowly, and then the patients are checked usually constantly. And of course, it's hard to have. We just don't have the manpower to do that in our clinical situations here in the United States. We're kind of manpower poor now in our clinic and hospital settings.
Now, what about Sydney? Is there any place, for the use of this with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia? In other words, if there were doctors who have the actual facilities to do this and do it properly, do you think it would be beneficial, or has this been approved for use here?
Well, it's been done in Nevada, not so much in California here where we reside, but in Nevada, for example, there are physicians in Reno and Las Vegas that use ozone treatments, for example. I'm not sure about the hydrogen peroxide, but at least they've used ozone treatments, and this is done by removing a sample of blood from the patient and then putting that sample of blood in an ozone generator, and so that the ozone saturates the blood and then slowly putting the blood back in the patient. The idea is basically the same, is that these types of microorganisms hate oxygen. They're very very suppressed by high oxygen concentrations, and of course they're stimulated by low oxygen concentrations. And this is why when people have these types of infections, and they have, for example, chronic fatigue syndrome, and they take a long airline flight, within days after that flight they often relapse. They come down with very severe signs and symptoms. Also, if they go to high altitude and stay for a long period of time, same problem. It's usually because the low oxygen tension fails to suppress these microorganisms, whereas high oxygen tension will suppress them.
What about hyperbaric chambers? I was talking with a woman just this last weekend who works in a hyperbaric chamber in her hospital, where, of course, they treat various types of things with hyperbaric oxygen. Would that have any benefit on this type of...
Well, we think it will. We've done just some very preliminary pilot studies using antibiotics and hyperbaric oxygen, and there is an additive effect there, a synergistic effect of the two. So I think in the future these things will be worthwhile. Now, some chronic fatigue patients have done very well on hyperbaric oxygen, for example. Others have not. And it may depend upon whether they have these types of infections that are sensitive to the high oxygen, or whether their chronic illnesses are due to some other reason, like chemical exposures or something like this.
Maria, do you have any other questions you'd like to ask?
I do, if you have time. Just
well, I'll tell you what, you're
going
to, you just hang on here.
Thanks.
We're going to a break, and we'll just let you come on afterwards and ask your question. And then, of course, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson. And we have Maria calling from Santa Cruz. Did you have another question with Dr. Nicholson?
I was wondering if there's any other, you know, like oregano oil, other things besides antibiotics. And then I had another quick question beyond
that. That's one question at a time.
Right.
You'll get the other question in. But Maria's wondering if there are anything else that you could do to build up your immunity. And she's talking about oil of oregano. And she probably is going to next mention maybe olive leaf extract and garlic and onions, all of these things which are known as natural antibiotics. Is there any place for these in the treatment of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia?
Well, we think they're important. And mainly we feel they're important after you get off the antibiotics. You need to be on a maintenance schedule. In addition to some of the natural anti-infectives, there are some immune potentiating or immune nutraceutical agents that are, I think, really quite useful. And there are a number of different products out there. I'm not going to mention them by name, which are really quite useful. And there's another whole area that I'd like to discuss if we have time, and that's mitochondrial function. Mitochondria is the little batteries inside all of our cells, and those little batteries are necessary to provide the energy, the high-energy molecules that we need to function. And without those, we just become... we lose energy and we become chronically ill.
Well, let's if Maria has one more quick question,
quick.
And then of course I really want to get into the mitochondria because this is really the battery, the energy source for our cells. Maria, one more quick question.
Just real quick, have you heard of other patients who have like weird food reactions, like all these allergies to all kinds of foods? And
very
do you
common.
Know anything that can be done? Because there's hardly anything. I'm getting more and more to where there's not a lot left I can eat, and I'm.
It seems to be very common. Now, we're not sure of all the details on this, but certainly the patients that have these chronic infections often have unusual allergies and so on and so forth. In general, what we found is that these tend to resolve once the infections are successfully treated. It can take a long time. A lot of these infections take over a year to treat, but when the infections are resolved, often those other problems resolve along with it.
Okay, so like taking antibiotics or something then would be the way to resolve that?
Well, that's, you know, one way to do it. There are some other ways. There are some products, there's some nutraceutical products that happen to have natural antibiotic properties, and for those that don't want to take antibiotics, they can pursue some of these. For example, there's a company in Austin, Texas, called Rain Tree, in which they've gone down to the Amazon and they found that there's certain plants that are native to the Brazilian Amazon area that are very effective in as antimicrobials. Some of these might be very useful.
Hold that, we'll be right back. I guess this evening, Dr. Garth Nicholson, and we were talking with Maria from the Santa Cruz area, who has chronic fatigue. And, of course, she was asking about taking antibiotics, and Dr. Nicholson was commented that there are some natural products, and he was mentioning one put together by somebody called the Rain Tree Organization, a company that has a herbal product, which apparently is sort of a natural antibiotic of some sort.
Yes, these are natural antimicrobials that are made from Amazon plants.
Now, are these things posted, discussed up on your website?
Yes, they're... If you go to our website, which is www.immed.org, it's like immediate.org, under treatment considerations, if you download the first document, the first publication there, it's discussed in there. In fact, there's a website and a telephone number for this organization and others as well that have natural products that seem to be effective either in boosting the immune system or that have natural antibiotic and antiviral activities.
So, Maria, that's IMMED. Do you have access to a computer?
No, but I'll get someone to print it out
okay,
for me. Thank you so much, both of you, for your time.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Okay, fine. That was Maria calling. And first, let's get onto a discussion of the mitochondria, because perhaps you could just explain for our listeners out across America what the mitochondria are and why they're so important and why, of course, these chronic infections seem to deactivate them.
Well, you know, every cell needs energy to perform all the functions that a cell normally does, and that energy has to come from somewhere, and the energy comes from breaking down molecules, and the molecules that we break down, and then we have to break them down and then shift them into high energy molecules that are utilized by the cell, and that occurs in what's called little organelles, which are appendages of our cells, and the little organelles that do this in our own cells are called mitochondria. And mitochondria are like little batteries. They actually convert energy from chemicals into high-energy chemicals that can be used by the cells. So they may, for example, burn down fats and take the energy from the fats that they break down and make that into high-energy molecules like ATP and other molecules that provide energy for the cell. And without that, we're dependent upon some kind of rudimentary metabolic pathways called anaerobic metabolism that doesn't depend upon oxygen. The mitochondria depend upon oxygen. So all of the oxygen that we bring in our bodies that's being used to help us burn sugars and fats, actually this occurs with the help of the mitochondria. So the mitochondria are absolutely essential for most of our energy that we have, that we require in our normal day-to-day functions, for example. So when this system is impaired, when the mitochondria are impaired, we lose this capacity for energy. This happens naturally during aging. For example, we've done some studies, and other people have as well, and what we found is that when patients get older, when they get in their 60s, 70s, 80s, for example, they lose 30, 40, almost 50% of their mitochondrial function, and this is one reason why I think people slow down when they get older. And so we've been working with some companies that produce agents that help restore mitochondrial function. And one of the things that happens with mitochondria is that they're surrounded by a membrane. And this membrane is made up of very particular lipids. And these form a barrier. Now, this is kind of like the insulation around a battery. You know, if you have a battery in your flashlight, and if you rip the insulation off the battery runs down very quickly, and then all of a sudden your flashlight won't work anymore. So you require that insulation to protect the battery so that it can produce the energy in the flashlight. The same thing with the mitochondria. If we tear apart the membrane around the mitochondria or make it leaky, then all of a sudden it's like running down the battery. So we know that we can't have leaky mitochondria, and this is one thing that happens with aging. It also happens in these chronic diseases like fibromyalgia syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome, and other fatiguing illnesses. Most of these patients, or almost all of them, have a problem with their mitochondria. So we've been looking into the use of over-the-counter types of supplements that can be used to replace these damaged lipids in the mitochondria. And one of the best that we've found is a supplement that's actually made from soy mitochondria, and that's in soy membranes, and that's a product called NT Factor, and it's sold by a company in New York. And we've done two clinical trials on this. We're ready to start a third one. In the two clinical trials that we did, we were able to take patients either with chronic fatigue syndrome or with aging patients, for example, that had fatigue, whether they were diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome or not, and show that we could restore their function of their mitochondria, and at the same time, we could reduce the amount of fatigue very dramatically in those patients. So we think that that's one thing that goes wrong with people that are chronically ill is their mitochondria get damaged. And one of the things that happens when these chronic infections enter our cells, either the viruses or the bacteria, particularly the bacteria, they give off substances which attack the mitochondrial membrane and damage it. So we know that if you have these infections, your mitochondria are going to be damaged. So in addition to treating the infection, you've got to repair the mitochondria and repair the other membranes of the cell. And so that's why we're recommending these supplements to help in the repair process and help restore function to the mitochondria.
Well, now, what about vitamins and what about minerals and what about this sort of thing? Do they play a part in that?
Absolutely, because many of these vitamins and minerals are incredibly important in determining the enzyme activity and the structural integrity of things like the mitochondria and the enzymes in the mitochondria and so on. And there are also certain vitamins that are depleted in these chronic illness states. And one of the studies that we were doing with a group in Dallas, for example, was to study B-complex vitamins. And we found that most patients that have these chronic illnesses, whether it's Gulf War illness or chronic fatigue syndrome or whatever, have depletions of their complex B vitamins. And these vitamins are absolutely necessary for metabolism and for your immunology and for your responses against infection and so on and so forth. So this is the one of the things that really happens. There are certain minerals that are also depleted as well in these chronic illness states and should be supplemented. Again, that information is on our website if somebody's really interested. And there are certain dietary considerations, and maybe the last part of our talk we could get into diet a bit, because this is extremely important for the health of anyone that has that's chronically ill.
Well, please do. We've got about 15 minutes, and I think that certainly we want to offer people something specific. You know, if they listen to this length of time, what can they do themselves to help themselves rather than running to the doctor and saying, cure me? After all, the human body is the most amazing mechanism that has, I think, all sorts of means of correcting itself if treated properly. But here, I think, is where the diet would fit in, wouldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've mentioned that things like the vitamins and minerals and so on, which are important, and then, of course, diet is very important. And one of the problems that we face in our country, in our part of the world, is that we're on these very high-sugar, high-fat diets, which are devastating, I think, to our health. And so one of the first things we try and do with people that have chronic illnesses, particularly if they have these infections, is get them off the high-sugar diet that we see in the United States and other areas around the world that have these severe problems. So that's the first thing, is to get off the processed sugar as much as possible and get back to more natural foods, more natural diets, and so on and so forth. So that's incredibly important, to eat a lot more vegetables, for example, and so on, and lower the amount of sugar in your diet or remove as much as possible of the sugar in your diet. Very important. And in addition to eating healthy is very important, so getting the proper balance of the proper foods and so on, I think, is incredibly important. There's some other things that we have to do to take care of our guts. For example, we recommend that patients that have these chronic illnesses take a lot of probiotics, these friendly bacteria. In fact, you probably have some organizations that are sponsoring your programs that sell some of these products like Lactobacillus acidophilus and other friendly bacteria that can help replace the depleted gut bacteria. These are so important for digestion. They're so important for absorption and so on. And so we need to have these probiotics. Anybody that's sick should be taking these kinds of things. In addition to, I mentioned the mitochondrial lipids and so on that are needed to actually replace the oxidized and damaged lipids in our membranes.
Well, now, of course, would that be good for somebody with chronic fatigue syndrome?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, these types of things, I think anybody that has a chronic illness should be following some of the instructions, the dietary instructions that we have on our website. And there's one paper that you can download, for example, that gives 18 suggestions, dietary suggestions, for people who are chronically ill. And we've gone through a few of these now in terms of vitamins and minerals and supplements and so on and so forth. These are incredibly important. We mentioned and we touched upon it very briefly, the role of immune enhancement products. And there are a number of different herbal products and natural sources of these immune-boosting products, which I think are very, very useful for all these chronic illnesses. The one thing that we can't tell people is which product they should take, because as it turns out, if you're going to boost somebody's immune system, I don't think you can accurately tell them which of these products to take. They more or less have to try this on their own. They have to try a few of these and see what works best for them. There's so many different products out there, it's hard to know exactly where to start, but there are some suggestions on our website.
Are you aware or acquainted with a product called Alamax, which is a garlic product that supposedly is pure allicin, which apparently is the active ingredient in garlic?
Yes, and again, that's one of the products that we recommend. There's some other, you mentioned oil of oregano, for example, and there's some other natural products that have natural antimicrobial activities, for example, or they have the natural immune boosting activities. And I think both of these strategies are probably important in chronic illnesses, a variety of chronic illnesses. So that's why people that eat all these natural things and take these natural supplements and so on are in so much better health than the average person out there on the street.
I'd like to ask you something. There are an awful lot of people within the conservative community who are taking colloidal silver. And, of course, silver is a great antimicrobial on the skin. Use it in burns, and certainly very, very good topically, but how do you feel about taking that internally?
Well, I just don't know. There are some people that swear by it and other people that claim that, no, it's not really, causing a major effect. We got a lot of feedback from the Gulf War veterans who were taking colloidal silver, and for the most part, they didn't really gain much benefit from it. That's not to say that under certain circumstances it might not be beneficial, and it may be that there are only certain types of colloidal silver that are really beneficial. A lot of the colloidal silver that is sold commercially out there is probably put in the category of junk. There's some products that may be very good, that have very fine particles, are freshly made, and so on and so forth, and that may be the way to go. One of the problems, of course, of colloidal silver is that you have to get it where it's needed, and in the case of a lot of these chronic illnesses where we have intracellular bacterial and viral infections, the colloidal silver really can't get at them. It can't get inside those cells and for the most part and get at those sources of infection. So we require much smaller molecular targets or much smaller molecules to go in and actually get those, and that's why things like antibiotics or small molecules go in and attack the metabolism specifically of the microorganism are the most effective, and some of these other things are less effective.
Well, there's a product that's being marketed today. It's called resveratrol, and it's the active ingredient in wine. Apparently, it has some sort of a genetic effect, like chronic fasting, but of course, you don't have to fast. Have you looked into that? Is there any basis in this, the claims made for resveratrol?
No, we haven't. It's interesting. New product, and there are a lot of these coming out, and we have some, for example, that we're working with. They're from Africa that are kind of interesting, and we hope to develop these as products as we use them in our clinics in Africa and perform do the clinical trials. A lot of these new products that come out, particularly the over-the-counter products and so on, come out based on anecdotal studies, and very few of these actually have true clinical trials that back up the claims made by the manufacturers or the companies that sell them, and that's one of the things that we're going to have to correct in the future.
Well, I think that most of the people who are selling these really believe in them, but you have to have some sort of scientific basis for it, and you have to know, whether the molecule is really effective in the way that it's being presented. And I know that a lot of resveratrol is sold to health food stores, but apparently if you actually check it out clinically, in the laboratory, it really isn't effective. So, I think it's so important what you were doing in the way of trying to come up with these new alternatives, and I'm sure that there must be other alternatives to the high-priced antibiotics that we're using. Certainly, there's a place for them, and they're wonderful, they're life-saving, but I think all of these other things that boost the immune system may be equally important.
Well, I think you're right, and I think we're just going to have to sort through this with very carefully designed clinical trials, and that's one of the things that we're going to be concentrating on in the future. And as we start a new program in Africa that we've received some international funding to help with the AIDS pandemic, there we have a major problem in terms of we just can't afford the Western antiviral medicines. Because there's just not enough money in the world to supply, several hundred million people in Africa with these products that are needed. So how do you do this in a reasonable way? And so we've come to the conclusion that a lot of these people will have to be treated with more natural herbal type approaches and so on. it's just going to be more cost effective because we can grow them right in country and right where they're needed and so on. And at the same time, it also gives employment to the people that need employment badly. In many of these areas, there's 50-60% unemployment, and that's part of the problem. So we're trying to look for low-tech solutions to some of these problems. And so that's why we're going to be leaning in the future more on these natural products than on pharmaceutical drugs.
Well, of course, the AIDS epidemic in Africa and spreading into other parts of the world is one of the greatest human tragedies of all time. And, well over 20 million people dead and another 40 million people probably alone in Africa already infected and just waiting to progress to death. You know, I think the average person in America would find it hard to believe that there could be anything of this magnitude, and yet it's going on today halfway around the world.
Well, if you go down there, and very few people actually do, and you actually go into some of these clinics and see the level of human suffering, it's staggering. And if you look at some of the countries that we're working in, Botswana, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Zambia, where in many cases there are 50% of the people, 40 to 50% of the people are HIV positive, and there's already a whole generation that's been wiped out. And so it's just a very bleak situation that it's going to require tremendous effort to try and turn this around.
And I think that, of course, what's so significant, you know, when you consider the tremendous incidence of this disease in Botswana, certainly one of the most prosperous countries in all of Africa, probably outside of South Africa and Rhodesia, it was the most prosperous country and had a fairly high standard of living for many of its people, and yet with the disastrous levels of HIV infection. We're going to be back. We've just got about 3 minutes before we wrap up this evening's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening has been Dr. Garth Nicholson from the Institute of, IMMED, that's the Institute of Molecular Medicine. And, of course, we've got just about 2.5 minutes. What were your parting thoughts for our listeners be this evening?
Well, I think the parting thought should be a very positive one. There are a lot of new developments out there, particularly in the area of natural medicines and supplements and so on that can help people that are chronically ill. Although the rate of chronic illness has skyrocketed in the last few years, we have a number of new things that people can use to fight these types of illnesses and so on. We also know more about these illnesses than we did before. We know some of the background, some of the, for example, infections and some of the toxic exposures that can exacerbate these illnesses or even cause these illnesses. And so that gives us a new approach to treat these illnesses that we didn't have a few years ago. And I think that's very important. It's a very positive type of development. And also, I think the recognition that things like diet, things like vitamins and minerals and supplements and so on play a very important role. This means that patients themselves are going to have to take the responsibility to do some of the treatment themselves. And as you mentioned, they can't just fall back on their general practitioner or their HMO or whatever and expect to get any help, because they're not going to be able to find that type of help that they need through the traditional medical providers situation that we have in this country. So they're going to have to take it upon themselves to find out more about their illness, to find out more about the types of things that they can do themselves to benefit their own clinical situation.
So can we suggest that you go to immed.org, that's immed.org, and get the material from Dr. Garth Nicholson's website, read it through, study it. There's a lot that you can do, and after all, it's your health. It's not your doctor's health. It's not your HMO's health. It's your health, and it's going to be up to you to look after yourself and your family. Dr. Nicholson, thank you so very much for being with us. It's been sort of a marathon, but I always learn a great deal whenever you're on with us.
Well, thanks again for having me on your show.
Glad. Thank you so much. Good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, that was Dr. Garth Nicholson, and certainly one of the people that I enjoy having as a guest on my program. I hope you're enjoying him as much as we do, because if you look around the country, the people who are dealing with chronic infections, The one person, of course, they always mention is Dr. Nicholson, and the fact that he's willing to take a couple of hours to come on to talk about these chronic infections that are disabling so many people all across our country, really all across the world today. And a lot of these are brand new illnesses. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day, reaching out by radio 5 hours a day, shortwave 4 hours a day, internet 5 hours a day, satellite 5 hours a day. What a unique opportunity to do what we do, and I feel it's a real privilege, but we still have to let you know we depend upon you. If you believe in what we're doing, if you believe there's a problem, if you believe we're going to be able to give you information you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, why give serious consideration to calling us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, where can you get the information? We're talking about certainly Dr. Nicholson's website. We carry a wonderful book, though, that we wouldn't be without. My wife refers to it frequently. In fact, she has her own copy of the book. It's called Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life by Dr. Russell Blaylock. And great information in there on so many of the things that you need to know about health, about food, about minerals, about vitamins, about what you need to protect yourself and your family. That's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. Now, we also have a four-tape set that goes with that. It's called Life-Saving Health Secrets, and it just happens to be four interviews with Dr. Russell Blaylock. And we also carry Dr. Blaylock's excellent book, Natural Strategies for Cancer Patients. That's Natural Strategies or Therapies for Cancer Patients. We also carry Dr. Blaylock's books, Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, going into the background of aspartame, which is a poison that is being put in almost all of your food products, and I don't think it put it there by accident. This was, of course, engineered by a man who was really responsible for the death of 100,000 Iraqi civilians since we entered the war in Iraq. But the man is Donald Rumsfeld, who back in 1980, when he was the CEO of Sears company that actually had the patent on a nutrition aspartame, used his political power and, of course, ran ruthlessly roughshod over the FDA bureaucrats and forced them to accept and release aspartame, which is made of a methanol, which is a deadly poison, aspartic acid, which is a deadly poison, and, of course, phenylalanine, which in excessive doses can have dramatic damage and effect on the brain and on nervous tissue. So you really need to understand that the danger of aspartame and NutraSweet, and that's covered in Dr. Russell Blaylock's excellent book, Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills. Now, of course, we also have a four-tape set on aspartame. We have a four-tape set on mercury. We have a four-tape set on fluoride, and they really are poisoning the American people. And there are some people out there who know exactly what they're doing. And, of course, we'll be covering that in some of our future newsletters, but you can go up on our website and pull down. I believe it was last year. It was June and July, or July and August. And we have, of course, a timeline for all the new diseases that have been created. There's a brand-new disease. It's called Marburg's disease. It was actually found in Marburg, Germany, in laboratory animals sent from Africa to be killed so that they could grow the polio virus that was going to be given to all of the people of Europe. And of course, this was the polio vaccine. Had the monkeys not started dying spontaneously, and then the people started dying spontaneously, they would have made up a batch of polio vaccine and killed countless millions of people. Why did it occur in laboratory monkeys? Well, so many of these diseases first appear in laboratory monkeys, almost like they've been produced in the laboratory. You need to get our various articles on the polio vaccine, on the new diseases. They're up there on my website at radioliberty.com. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty. We'll be back again on Thursday.